This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. My guest today is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers one of the great explorations of our time. But this is not an exploration to outer space or under the sea. This is inward, to our cells, to examine the genetic material that shapes who we are and, to an extent, what diseases we'll fall heir to and even what shapes our personalities may be. This is the charting of the human genome, the genetic structure of human beings. Researchers have advanced our knowledge rapidly in the past decade. Michael Waldholst has co-authored with Jerry Bishop a journal of these scientific discoveries called Genome. Now, here's a quick refresher course on genetic biology in less than 30 seconds. Each of us carries all the physical information about ourselves, our height, blood type, hair, eye color, and so on long strands of DNA called chromosomes. We have 23 pair of these chromosomes, and the chemical messages called genes that determine our characteristics reside on these chromosomes. Scientists calculate we humans have somewhere between 50 and 100,000 genes. Since a gene is a conceptual designation and you can't really see one, I ask Michael Waldholst, how is it possible to map them?
Well, to be perfectly honest, there are ways of measuring their presence. And the breakthrough that occurred that has allowed for scientists in the last 5 to 10 years to really go on a gene hunt is a technology called gene markers, in which scientists are able to actually identify bits of DNA. DNA, of course, is the genetic material of which all genes are made. And although there are 50,000 to 100,000 genes in every cell, there is lots of DNA between these genes. Some people call it junk DNA, but it really probably does serve a purpose. And what's occurred in the last 10 years is the ability for scientists to identify these markers. They're sort of like signposts by the roadside that tell these sort of scientific drivers where they are in the DNA. And what's occurred is the ability to follow these markers as they get passed from one generation to another. As these markers are passed from one generation to another, genes that reside near these markers are also passed along. So that really what's the genome project is often referred to as a mapping project, because really what scientists are doing is locating the approximate location or mapping the approximate location of these genes within the huge mass of DNA within each cell.
I understand that the discovery of these markers and the idea that markers could be used to find genetic material came about through serendipity, through a scientific accident in a way, just a coincidence of scientists passing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of scientific discoveries occur when there is this amalgam of, you bring people together from various disciplines, and one person asks a question and doesn't realize that the answer has already been found in a separate discipline. What's often happens is that scientists keep to their own sort of a little cubbyhole, so to speak, and don't get out enough to speak to scientists who might be doing something that provides an important answer. And what happened in 1978 is a group of scientists gathered at a ski lodge above Salt Lake City in what's called the Alta Lodge in the Wasatch Mountains in Utah to do in some ways it was a retreat for graduate students at the University of Utah who are studying various aspects of genetics to sort of talk about their work and to sort of be advised by some high-powered geneticists from other universities. It so happened that one of the geneticists sitting and listening to the grad students was David Botstein from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he understood that these graduate students who were trying to trace the inheritance of certain diseases needed these markers. I mean, he could hear it from what they were saying, that they said, listen, if we had markers all over the genome that we could use as signposts, we could begin tracking down genes. Right now, we don't have them. And Botstein said, and I guess what was a sort of a eureka moment in science, well, we have those kinds of markers. I didn't know anyone wanted them.
Huh. Could the Genome Project have proceeded without these markers?
Absolutely not. And in fact, David Botstein has sort of dropped in and out of the project these gene hunting escapades over the decade. And he is now at Stanford University and a very active participant in the Genome Project.
Why do you call them escapades?
Well, because each gene discovery is in itself a sort of a separate adventure. For instance, we tell in the book, we decide to tell several of these escapades, although we could have told many more. We chose one in particular to start off with because it was the first escapade to use this marker technology in 1983, and this involved the gene for Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is a terribly crippling illness that strikes its victim in their early 40s to early 50s. Now, people who have inherited Huntington's disease gene are fated to get this illness from the moment they're conceived, from the moment of conception. And yet, prior to the discovery of the gene in 1983, there was no way to tell who had inherited the gene and who didn't. People would know, for instance, that they had a 50% risk of getting the gene if one of their parents had the illness. Now, the escapade itself involved another family, the Wexler family, in particular Nancy Wexler and her father Milton, who began in 1968 to look for the gene when they realized that that Nancy's mother, Leonore, had the disease. But not until this marker technology was created in 1979 did the Wexlers have a way of looking for the gene itself.
My guest is Michael Waldholz. He's written a book with Jerry Bishop called Genome, the study of the attempt to map all the genes in the human body. How do you find out the genetic pattern of someone? What is the ideal sort of research body that a geneticist can use to track down a gene, say a Huntington's disease gene?
Well, you know, initially the primary way that you go looking for whether a disease is due to a gene is by following its pattern of inheritance, by massing together a so-called pedigree or family tree, in which you look at a very large family or you look at a family with many branches, and you follow a particular trait. And if in various generations that trait or disease occurs with a certain kind of pattern of occurrence, let's say 50% of all offspring have the same pattern trait as a parent, then it would be likely to expect that that trait was inherited from that parent.
What makes Mormons so valuable to genetic researchers?
The Mormons, who are based around Salt Lake City and throughout Utah, have become especially important as one of several groups of clans because they have very large families with extended branches. It was throughout the 19th and 20th century, it was very common for Mormon families to have 7, 8, 9, 10 children. And those children would each have as many offspring themselves. So that for a geneticist who wants to trace a disease as it passed through its family, you would need this very large family. And while, in fact, throughout America and throughout the world there are such large families, what you have in Utah is a very, very large clustering of many of these kinds of families. Not only that, but the Mormons have kept a very close track of their family history, going back many generations, so that if a geneticist wanted to know if a particular grandfather or great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather had a particular kind of illness, there were records around describing how that person died, what kind of maladies they had, and from that the geneticist could piece together whether a particular family had this very high rate of a certain disease. And in fact, the Mormons have been very useful to the scientists at the University of Utah in tracking down recently the gene for neurofibromatosis, which is often called elephant man disease.
Genetic studies can often reveal some secrets that families have long kept dark. For instance, if there's been a history of mental illness or some other disease that may not have been fully understood and an antecedent to grandparent was maybe put into a mental home or died a particularly terrible death, sometimes it's kept a secret, and then it's only through genetic testing is it revealed that perhaps someone actually had a severe form of depression or of Huntington's disease. I was curious in the role that family secrets play in obscuring our genetic history.
Well, in fact, in the instance of, for instance, of the Wexler family, Nancy Wexler's three uncles, her mother's three brothers, all died of Huntington's disease. And in fact, Nancy's grandfather, her mother's father, also died of Huntington's disease. And yet, the actual fact, the reason that they died, was kept very, as Nancy says, very hush-hush. No one wanted to admit, I don't think, and especially Leonora didn't want to admit, that somehow she harbored this potentially damaging gene, both for her own personal health. I think it made it possible to live her life believing that she wasn't at risk of having this terribly tragic illness. And she also didn't want to believe that she could have passed it on to her two daughters. And I think as long as there was no medical way of knowing, no test for knowing for sure whether she had the gene and whether she had passed it on to her daughters, I think she could hope as long as she didn't know. Now that we have this test, you very consciously have to make a decision not to get tested. And if you don't get tested and you have children, you have to be very conscious about the fact that you don't want your children to know either.
How did you become interested in the Genome Project?
Actually, I met Mark Skolnick from the University of Utah in late 1985. He was here. He was in New York at Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital, the very famous cancer center here, doing a sabbatical. And someone had tipped me off that he was here in New York and that he was someone who was very interested in trying to find patterns of how traits were being passed in families. Actually, I was doing some research in diabetes, and a diabetes researcher said that he had collaborated with Skolnick on looking for large families in which diabetes seemed to run in the family. And he said, if you really want to talk to someone who has thrown himself into this field, you ought to speak with Mark. And he very rapidly, in a series of lunch get-togethers and then longer meetings, sort of began introducing me to this mapping adventure that was being taken place all over the world in very informal projects. It wasn't a formal genome project at the time. My colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Jerry Bishop, was also at the time looking into the fact that heart disease may be caused by the inheritance of certain genes. And when we started discussing at one point the fact that we were both looking into sort of genetics, we decided to do a series of stories for the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And that was the inspiration for the book.
There have been a number of ethical issues raised as a result of genetic information that we now know, ranging from prenatal testing or even what is euphemistically called pre-embryo testing, you know, when the human organism is no more than 8 cells or so in size, to knowledge that we have of our own future in a way by knowing what our predisposition is toward disease. Is there much debate going on within the scientific community or who is actually on the mapping project, or is this a debate that exists outside the Genome Project?
I think the scientists themselves are now taking a very close look at what is being called the ethical or problematic side of being able to predict the future by looking in one's own genetic profile. It's a very powerful piece of knowledge we're beginning to develop here. And, you know, right now, as I said, no one really knows how many genes there are, perhaps 50,000, perhaps 100,000. And right now we've only mapped something around 4,000 to 5,000. So it's going to be a while before the rest are found. But the discoveries are coming at such a rapid pace that everyone is beginning to think, well, what's it going to be like when we can take a simple blood test and run a battery of tests and really have what is being called a genetic profile in which we can see our genetic strengths as well as our genetic weaknesses. We can see some traits which clearly there are going to be traits that are inherited that make some people, that give some people athletic ability, that give people stature, that account for intelligence. And also genes that probably predispose us to various mental health problems, manic depression and schizophrenia, as well as genes that cause very severe diseases such as cancer and heart disease. And being able to do this genetic profile raises a lot of questions. When do you do such a test? Do you do it at the moment of conception? And if you did at the moment of conception and were able to do a prenatal test, what would parents, prospective parents, do with that information? How would they decide what kind of children and what kind of traits would be good to keep and which kind might be worth discarding?
How likely is it that we can create a super race? Is this
The scientists themselves think it's very unlikely, and I have to agree with them. Because, you know, you still have to remember that you couldn't, that parents with very short, people of very short stature who come from long lines of very short stature people would have a hard time finding a gene for someone who might be 6'5" or even taller. So that individual parents are going to have a hard time choosing among their embryos, so to speak, and selecting someone who is a lot different than they are. And in fact, actually taking genes and manipulating them such that we would actually create human beings is something that is so far-fetched that I don't think any intelligent scientist thinks it's possible. More likely is the fact that we will be able to use genetic tests, either prenatally or after someone is born, to tell them the kind of genetic weaknesses they have. For instance, that is believed that there are something like 15 to 20, perhaps 25 genes that help the body process cholesterol. People who have very healthy, so to speak, healthy genes are able to process cholesterol in a very efficient way, and these people probably never will get heart disease. But anyone who had any of these genes in a defective fashion, somehow damaged, either inherited in a damaged form or somehow they were damaged later in life, might have trouble processing cholesterol. And this cholesterol might pile up in deposits in the arteries leading to the heart and could lead to a heart attack. Now, if you could do a genetic test of someone and say, listen, of the 15 to 25 genes that you need, you have 8 or 12 or 15 of them in a defective fashion, you're someone at very high risk of developing heart disease. And perhaps from even the earliest age, you should eat a very low-fat diet.
This also seems a way that, say, an insurance company could screen out an applicant, or an employer could say, no, I don't want to have the burden of somebody who has a predisposition toward heart disease or cancer of some kind.
Well, this is a very troubling aspect of the technology. Again, the people who are out there looking for the genes, the people who are trying to cure diseases that are terrible scourges, believe that the benefits far outweigh the potential risks of charting the entire genetic map, so to speak. But nonetheless, we have to face the fact that already we use various pieces of information to screen people out. Insurers already ask people if they have pre-existing health conditions. Employers often give people medical exams before they hire them. There are examples of people who are positive for the AIDS virus who can't get health insurance. What I'm trying to say is that insurers and employers already use information to screen potential applicants, and in fact probably already use other kinds of information to discriminate. We have discrimination of people on the basis of their sex, of their race, and people who are disabled already. I think the concern is that if employers somehow got a hold of a person's genetic profile and saw that, in fact, they were at high risk of developing heart disease or cancer, they might want to screen them out because they might not want these people to incur the high medical bills that they might develop if indeed they ever develop the disease itself. Again, it's a bit far off, but it's not inconceivable, and the technology certainly exists.
One of the people that you follow in the book is Nancy Wexler, who's led a crusade to find the cause of Huntington's disease, the gene for it. Has she herself been tested?
You know, Nancy's been very coy about it. It's not clear to me that, in fact, she has or has not. She certainly won't say. I think she has felt that this is a very private issue. And she, in fact, is now sitting on a committee that is discussing the ethical and legal issues surrounding the mapping of the entire genome. And her committee is attempting to come up with the kind of safeguards that might be needed, whether it's regulations or legislation or some expansion of the Civil Rights Act, to make sure that people are able to keep their genetic profiles confidential. Or if, in fact, employers or insurers need to, for some reason, to see an individual's genetic profile, that it not be abused. And I think in her own personal life, she's sort of felt that that if it was known that she was at risk, that information, she might become some kind of a celebrity in a way that I don't think she wants to become. You know, back in 1983, when she led this crusade and the gene itself was located, they don't have the gene itself. They only have a test for the gene right now. They have a marker that can tell whether a person has the gene. I think at that point she wanted to be tested. She was in her late 30s at the time, and although since she had known she was at risk of having this disease, I think she had decided not to ever have a family and not to put prospective children at risk. And I think very quickly she decided, well, I could take this gene and this test and find out if I had the gene and I could have a family. And I think her father and her sister and herself decided, well, what would happen if she or her sister, for instance, was found to have the gene and the other one didn't? I think all of a sudden the consequence of having the gene was something that was something that she didn't want to have to think about. As long as she didn't know for sure, she could always hope that she didn't, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes absolute sense. The idea that knowledge can destroy hope is a terrifying side of this genome project.
Nancy and several others make the point that we're in a very, very rocky period of genetic discovery right now. And Huntington's disease is always used as the example. You can use this gene test now to tell whether, in fact, you will have this terrible illness decades in the future, but there's nothing you can do for it. And as long as you can diagnose for disease, but you can't do anything about it, you're going to have a very problematic time in medicine right now.
Many of the scientists involved in this project view the study of the genome as a crusade. Do you, as a reporter, view it as a crusade, or is this the story for you for the rest of your career?
I think genetics is going to be the most important story in medicine, and I'm a medical science reporter, and I think most all the important stories in medicine, beginning certainly for the next 10 years and into the next century, will be based on genetic discoveries. I think new drugs will be based on genetic discoveries. Some scientists think that we are on the verge of a new era of medicine, which they call predictive medicine, which a fundamental change is taking place. Some people think that this fundamental change is perhaps dwarfs many of the great medical wonders of the 20th century, such as the discovery of penicillin or the X-ray, because for the first time, doctors will be able not just to, doctors basically right now struggle to fight and treat the sick. With this genetic information, they'll be able to predict an illness before it arises and perhaps even prevent it from occurring.
My guest has been reporter Michael Waldholz. His new book is Genome. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.